Okay, well, officially good morning again. Morning, thank you. We have been going through the Bible. We'll go back for those who are new, just doing a 7-year plan of going through the whole counsel of God. And it's going to be more like a 10-year plan, I think, by the time we're done. Maybe a 100-year plan by the time we're done. But anyways, but the goal was a 7-year plan, Sunday school, morning service, Wednesday nights, going through the whole counsel of God. And right now, during the morning service, we're really looking, have been going through a biblical history of Israel. On and off, we've, throughout the different ones, we've considered Genesis through Deuteronomy, through the whole Pentateuch. And then we've started then, again, coming through Joshua, turn this thing on, from Joshua and then Judges into Ruth. And we moved into Samuel and finished up the Judges and moved into the kings, into the kingdom of Israel. And we've considered Saul, and we've considered David, and right before Advent season, we finished up with the life of David, and we're transitioning into the kingdom of Solomon, and then took that hiatus as we went through the impact of the incarnation by looking at the book of 1 John. And last week, we came back wholeheartedly into this study and looking at the establishment of Solomon's throne, that Solomon becomes king, David is now dead, Solomon becomes a king, and the first thing he does when he becomes king is he establishes his throne by securing the interior. He takes care of the Adonijah, his brother, half-brother, but still his brother, who was seeking to usurp his throne, and so Adonijah is dispatched of. And sadly then, Abiathar, who was the priest, was sent away to Anathoth because Abiathar had joined in with the coup attempt, and so, but because of his relationship with David, Solomon had mercy upon him and said, you know, you head to Anathoth. And with that concept of mercy, remember that mercy had already been extended to Adonijah as well. He had basically said, don't do anything again, but Adonijah tried to get David's concubine as his wife, again, seeking to start that usurpation again. And then Joab hears what's going on, so he decides he's going to be killed, so he runs and flees to the altar, will not come from the altar, and so Solomon says to Benaiah, just go ahead and kill him there. And then he turns around to Shimei and shows mercy to Shimei. Shimei was the descendant of Saul, who had cursed David and told Shimei that he could live in Jerusalem as long as he lived in Jerusalem. He'd move to Jerusalem as long as he lived in Jerusalem, that he'd be fine. But the day he left Jerusalem would be his death sentence. And so he was under, if you would, house arrest, large house, though, the whole city of Jerusalem. But Shimei had two slaves that ran away, and that day Shimei decided what? Go get his slaves. But on the day that he decided to go get his slaves, he also decided that he was going to sign his own death warrant. So when he comes back to Jerusalem, Solomon takes him and dispatches of Shimei as well. And so then he does the final step, which we see in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 to 3, and he secures the borders, if you would, by marrying Pharaoh's daughter. That little detail is going to come into play a little bit later, okay? So he marries Pharaoh's daughter and then makes a treaty with his enemy. It really is what, and we talked about that at the very end last week, didn't spend a lot of time on it, but the fact is that, again, this is one of the details, the first steps that we see in Solomon where he starts to disregard the directives of God. Yeah, I mean, the direct revelation of God, where God has clearly stated what a king of Israel should and should not do, and this was one thing that was totally against it. We'll bring that out as we go. But he makes this treaty with Egypt, who is the enemy of God's people, and he does that. And so for us, again, the challenge to be careful of making treaties with our enemies, and we're not talking about physical, political enemies today. We're talking about spiritual enemies. You know, sometimes we'd like to make these treaties with Satan. We wouldn't call him that, but we just want to get that spiritual war off our back, and so we're willing to make concessions just to be able to not be in the war anymore, and that's not what, because I promise you that the evil one, our enemies, do not hold the treaties like if we would hold to a treaty. Today, though, we want to go into this next phase that is probably the phase that we think about the most when it comes to with Solomon. That is the wisdom of Solomon. And I want to ask you this question as we start. I'm going to ask it at the very end again. But if you were given the opportunity by God, if God came to you and asked you, ask anything you want, and I'll give it to you. Anything you want, I'll give it to you. I will be the genie in the bottle that you've always wanted. Pop me out. You have one wish. God, I wish for a million more wishes. It didn't happen that way, right? I mean, but now if you're smart, that's what you're thinking, because God, you know, I want a million wishes. Okay, well, I have to render that wish then. So now you have, I learned that one from Winnie the Pooh, just so you know. Anyways, that was Tigger. So anyways, so sorry, that came from the wishing well. So if you don't know kids' stuff, you just missed that one. So anyways, but what would you ask for? Would you want more money? Would you want a bigger house? Would you want the life of a friend or family member who is ailing and you want them to be healed? Would you pray, would you want peace on the earth? I mean, real peace. What would you want? Now, let's extend that and make it even harder for you, at least harder for me, okay? Because, again, remember, the illustrations that you give are the ones that God is killing me with, okay? And so I'd like to just share the wealth. What if it happened at nighttime? You know, nighttime, the time when whatever's really inside you starts to come out. You know, last night I was, Rich, I'm dreaming cabinets all night. I'm dreaming of cabinets. One big cabinet. I don't know where this cabinet's at, but somewhere on the job in Abbeville, there's a big cabinet that I can't figure out where it goes. Anyways, and so all your fears and trepidations start coming out in your dreams. Your lusts come out in your dreams. A lot of stuff that, you know, during the daytime that you suppress and whatever, they start coming out in your dreams. What if God came to you in a dream at night when you had no control, quote unquote, over your subconscious? And he said to you, what would you want? What would your answer be? What your answer would be a revelation of what's really going on inside you. From out of the depths of the heart, the mouth speaks. And that's what's really kind of cool, because Solomon is kind of, I get Solomon sometimes, as I get David, you know, Solomon is David's son, you know, and as we saw David was the man after God's own heart. And yet David what? Sinned greatly. I mean, how could you be a man after God's own heart and do some of the things that David did? Solomon, we're going to find out, is the what? The world's wisest man. The wisest man who ever lived. And yet he made some pretty dumb decisions. I get him. I understand him. And today's one of these highlights in Solomon's life. One of these moments we look at and go, wow, if that could be me, always. God comes and says, what do you want? And I say to him, oh God, when I consider the greatness of your chesed to my father David, of your goodness to these people, and your mercy and your chesed and the letting me be the king. Oh God, if you could just give me wisdom to be able to know how to discern right and wrong for these people so I could be the best king for your people ever. Wow, that I could be that selfless? And I'm only thinking about anybody else and everybody else? What a day, huh? Now, I'm not saying it's never happened in my life. It may have happened once or twice. Anyways, no, seriously. But you get that, right? How we struggle with our flesh. This is a highlight. And again, Solomon, we're going to find out that he struggles with what? His flesh. He's no different than we are. And so be careful as we go through this of not elevating Solomon to a pedestal that is beyond who he really is. He's a man whom God, in his sovereignty, yes, chose to use for his glory as well. We look a lot of times from the perspective of man, and we have the applications from the perspective of man, but I don't want us to neglect the fact that God is God. And every single one of us is deserving of hell. And if all of our thoughts were placed upon on the screen, every single one of us would be doing what? Trying to hide underneath the chair in front of us. So if that all happened, don't worry about it. Nobody's going to see it because every one of us is going to be hiding under the chair, okay? But we all struggle with this. Just as David struggled, just as Solomon struggled. And yet David is recorded as the man after God's own heart. And Solomon is still recorded as what? The wisest man ever lived. Isn't that fun? Isn't that cool? God is such a God of grace. So let's consider this wisdom of Solomon. And the first thing we see is in this passage, and then the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, okay, we'll consider that as well, is first of all the request. Now, we think of the request, first of all, as the request of Solomon. But that wasn't the first request. The first request was the request of God. See, this wasn't something that Solomon thought of. Solomon, first of all, we want to look at the setting. Solomon had gone to worship God. Now, where did he go? Where did he go to worship God? A high place. Where specifically? Gibeon. Why? Because that's where the tabernacle was. If we go to the First Chronicles passage, or Second Chronicles chapter 1 passage, we find out even more details, okay? And I don't want to necessarily go there right now, but you can go there because we're again covering that portion, okay? That's where the tabernacle of meeting was. That is not, now here's detail, it is not where the Ark of the Covenant was. Okay, class, where's the Ark of the Covenant? If it's not in the tabernacle meeting, wasn't that where it was supposed to be? Throughout the whole wilderness journey, it was in the tabernacle meeting. It's not in the tabernacle meeting right now. We've covered this. It's been quite a while ago now. Where is it at? It's in Jerusalem. Very good. Awesome. Okay. Why is it in Jerusalem? David brought it back. Well, David brought it back. Why did David bring it back? Where was it at? The Philistines had taken it. How did the Philistines get it? Because the Israelites thought of it as a good luck charm and took it out to battle with them. And they thought, oh, as long as we have the Ark of the Covenant in the battle with us, we'll win. God said, no, dude, you guys are all wrong. You're trusting in it's me. And so God allowed Israel that day to be defeated. Remember, the Ark of the Covenant was taken by the Philistines, and they placed it in the temple of Dagon, right? And the next morning they got up, and Dagon was what? Dagon was bowing at the Ark of the Covenant. And so they picked Dagon back up and said, don't tell anybody about this. The next day they woke up, and Dagon was not only bowing at the Ark of the Covenant, but his head was cut off and his arms were cut off. Okay? And so, can you imagine the patch job there, right? There's a whole lot of fixing going on there. And so they had to pick him back up, and at that point they decide, what? Ark of the Covenant, it's out of here. And they move it to the next Philistine town. And in that town, all of a sudden they start having tumors. They start having cancer. It's almost like a bubonic plague is really probably what was going on. The rats and stuff like that. And we know that because when they made the offering unto God, they made rats. They made mice, rats. These golden things looking like that of tumors and rats. And so more than likely there was this bubonic plague thing happening. So anyways, so Solomon then, he goes to the tabernacle of meeting where the great bronze altar was. And he goes to the great bronze altar, okay, because he wants to worship God, okay? And he offers up thousands of offerings, burnt offerings to God, okay? And, you know, from our perspective, we think, wow. But there's two sides to this that goes on as well. And this is kind of conjecture for you as well, bring argument from silence. There was that part, though, when you would offer free will offerings that this is going to sound tacky, and I'm not trying to diminish this, okay? But it was like a barbecue as well, okay? The animal was not only sacrificed, it was then cooked. Make sense? I'm thinking that Solomon invited the entire nation to this time of the restoration of the worship of God, okay? And they had a big feast, a big celebration. They came and they worshiped God, and there was all this meat, and all the people who came were fed. Solomon fed all the people. And so there was this large thing, and it's to me, it's really awesome. I mean, because Solomon is wanting to worship God in spirit and in truth, and he has it, and so he's offering it unto God. So in the midst of this, then, this is the setting, okay, he goes to bed that night after this day of celebration, of worshiping the God of Israel, okay, Yahweh. And Yahweh then appears to him in a dream. In a dream. Don't you ever wonder about your dreams? How do you know whether this dream is meaningful or not? Or was it just a pepperoni pizza that you ate last night? You know, what? Why? I mean, because clearly Pharaoh had lots of dreams at times, didn't he? And yet he woke up in the middle of the night and he had a what? He had a dream. Duh. He had lots of dreams. This dream was what? Important. He had had it twice. He knew it was something special. And so he calls for everybody to interpret it. The butler and the butcher, they had had their dreams. They thought there was something special. How did they know? Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, but he knew that somehow this dream was what? Special. How did he know it was special? Solomon has a what? A dream. Haven't you ever dreamt before? Is every dream you dream prophetic? How did he know that this was prophetic? I think you just know. Isn't that awful? That's an awful statement, isn't it? You just know. What do you mean you just know? God lets you know. I've had dreams that were, I felt very important, that were very, and I could share some of them with you, that were very, I don't say prophetic, changing the world kind of stuff, but they meant that God was talking to me and potentially others through me in a dream. And when I woke up, I just knew it. You know, a lot of dreams, you wake up and you what? You don't remember. You just kind of remember there. You had something about a cabinet. I know there was something about a cabinet, but I don't know anything else more about that cabinet. But this one I could tell you about. I can tell you exactly where it was. I still can picture the entire dream. I can tell you the people who were in that dream. I could tell you the details of everything that were in that dream. Make sense? Okay. But it was for me, and it was for the time back then. But it's still for me to know. There's an application that was for my ministry that it's going on, and I'll never forget it. Okay. And so it's very critical and important for me. Well, for Solomon, this wasn't a prophetic message for everybody. This was for him. We just have the blessing of what? Reading about it in God's Word. Because God wanted us to know about it. Okay? Why? Because Solomon is going to be seen to be the wisest man ever. And God wants us to know something. What do you think he wants you to know? That wisdom wasn't from Solomon himself. It was the blessing of God. God is going to give you abilities and talents that maybe somebody else doesn't have. But you remember the first part of that statement I just told you. We always tend to forget that part of it. God is going to give you abilities and talents. That's what he tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. That he has placed within his body those he seems fit, and that he has given us the gifts to each one as he sees fits for the profit of everybody. Does that make sense? Not for our own purpose. And so God is going to bless Solomon, but it's not for Solomon. It's for everybody else. Does that make sense? That's the key. And what Solomon, I think, forgets, and no, we're not, you know, Chuck and I were talking about it. We're going to get in Ecclesiastes. We could get in Ecclesiasties, and I may refer to Ecclesiastes, but you got to remember the book of Ecclesiastes is all about the wanderings of Solomon. And the guy had all the wisdom, and yet he leaves the wisdom of God to try to find wisdom of man. And that's what Ecclesiastes is all about, and he finds out that the wisdom of man is always meaningless. It's vanity of vanities. He's searching after for fulfillment of life from the eyes of man, and he doesn't find it. Why? Because he has it only in God alone. So God comes to Solomon in the setting, and he gives him the offer. Ask. Ask. What shall I give you? It's not just a request. It's really a command. Ask. Ask. Now, if you were with us in Sunday school over the time, and we've been going through the book of Isaiah in Sunday school, that you remember back in chapter 7, part of the beginning of the messianic prophecy about the birth of Christ, okay, where in chapter 7 we read about the virgin shall give birth to a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel, right? Well, that is actually a sign, okay? But it was a sign given to the house of David. But it was a sign given to the house of David as a response to the rejection of Ahaz, the king of Judah, to the request from God, who God said to Ahaz, ask me for a sign. He did the same thing as he does for Solomon. He doesn't limit them. He says, "Give me ask for a sign in the heavens or in the or below in the earth below. Ask anything you want, and I'll do it for you." And Ahaz says, "What? Oh no, far be it from me to ask a sign from God. Oh, I can't do that." And it sounds spiritual, but it wasn't. He was mocking God because he was putting his trust in Assyria, not in God. And so God comes back, Yahweh comes back and says, "Fine, I'm going to give you a sign, but it's not a sign to you, Ahaz. It's a sign unto the house of David. For a virgin shall give birth to a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." And then it goes continuing on into chapter 8, talking about how Assyria, who you're trusting in, is going to overflow its banks. Into chapter 9, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and his name shall be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace," so on and so forth. Okay? And so God has done this. And so he says, a command, ask, "What shall I give you?" What shall I give you? The question, the request, "What shall I give you?" Well, Solomon's response was what? Give me discernment. We'll talk about this in a moment. First, let's talk about the basis of his request. Look when he responds here in 1 Kings 3. This is so cool to me. He says, verse 6, Solomon said, "You have shown great..." Now, New King James says mercy, okay? New American Standard, I think ESV, says loving kindness. Am I right? Okay? "Great kindness, great mercy," I'll come back to it, "to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness and uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness," and so that's what the New American Standard and ESV says, and New King James says it as well here, "great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on the throne." In the New King James, that's kind of the one I preach from, mercy and kindness are the same word. It's chesed. It's the chesed of God. Okay? I love the word. And it's, for those who are new, it's my favorite word. In the entire Bible, the chesed. Chesed is my favorite word. You can clear out your throat with it, you know, if you're ever... Anyways, but it is the faithful, loving kindness of God to the objects of his covenant. And so you see it translated faithfulness, you see it translated mercy, you translated loving kindness. I mean, it is a faithful, loving kindness of God to the objects of his covenant. And so Solomon, he gets this request, and he's overwhelmed immediately with the chesed of God. "God, you are so faithfully, loving, and mercifully kind. This is amazing. I mean, who am I? Who am I to be even asked this question? I know what my father David did. And yet you have been so gadol chesed. You have been so gratefully, how am I going to say this in English? Just magnanimously, overwhelmingly faithful to my father David. You have shown him grace beyond measure. I'm just so overwhelmed with what you did for my father David." And he says it twice. "Your great kindness, your great kindness, your great kindness." So based upon that, and based upon the fact of my youth, that he turns around and says, "Now, O Lord my God," verse 7, "you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child." I want to do a real quick aside here for a moment, okay? Because everybody, we have the age of everybody, of all these kings. There's only one king that we don't ever read an age about. Guess who it is? Solomon. Solomon says he's a little child. Now, I've done study on this, okay? And there is like a lot of Jewish Hebraic tradition that he's 12 years old, okay, at this point when he becomes king. That's wrong. It's wrong, okay? Put it out of your brain. He's not 12 years old. I'll prove to you why he's not 12 years old, okay? And I'm going to tell you how old he is. No, I'm not joking. I'm not. I'm going to give you a range. I think, though, just tell you straight off, that he's about in 25-ish, okay? So give or take 3 years, probably in the ballpark. He's in his 20s, okay? Early 20s to late 20s, okay? Why? Okay? So let's talk about this real quick. What do we know about Solomon? First of all, we've got to go back to David, okay? How old was David when he became king in Jerusalem? Say again? Not 39, 37. He was 37. He was 30 when he became king in Hebron. He reigned in Hebron for 7 years. At that point, he goes to Jerusalem. So he's what? 37. Okay, pretty easy math problem. Okay, so he's 37. Now, the next question you need to know is, when was Solomon born? He wasn't born while he was in Hebron. There were 6 sons born to him while he was in Hebron. Okay, we had Absalom and Amnon and Adonijah, along with 3 others. Okay, but those are the 3 that we read about causing problems, right? And so those were all born to him in Hebron. So now he comes into Jerusalem, okay, and Solomon's born immediately, right? No, not at all. So the first thing that happens when he comes to Jerusalem is he's bringing in the Ark of the Covenant. There's that celebration. There's the securing of the borders. He's battling against all the nations around him, right? And so finally we get into chapter 11, okay, of 2 Samuel. And we finally read, there came a time when the kings go out to war that David decided what? Stay home. So I don't know how many years he was there, but in my mind, I think it's got to be at least 5 years that he's hanging out in Jerusalem, 5 to 8 years that this all is going on, okay? And so let's say for a moment it's 8 years that he comes to Jerusalem and he's there, okay? How old is he? He's 45. 45. When does he die? 70. Because he was 30 when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. So he dies when he's 70. So if he's 45, okay, and he dies when he's 70, how old is Solomon? 25. Make sense? Now, that's a ballpark, okay? And so that's why I said to give or take 3 years, because if it's only 5 years that all that took, then Solomon's a little bit older. But if it was more time till the time that he had with Delilah, because think about it, Delilah, Bathsheba, wrong story there. Anyways, Bathsheba, same concept, different era. Anyways, with Bathsheba, right? So first he has a relationship with Bathsheba. She goes through the pregnancy, and then baby what? Dies. Okay, he takes her, and then he consoles her, and then they go through the whole pregnancy thing again. So there's about 3 years out of that. So if there's 5 years of establishing the nation, right? And then there's 3 years of the Bathsheba incident. Again, it puts me at 8 years. So I'm putting Solomon in the 25 range. There's, again, one more detail here that tells me that he couldn't be any younger than 20. What's the detail that we already saw that tells me that he probably isn't any younger than 20? He already took a wife. Who did he take? Pharaoh's daughter. But you know what? There's even more details. That one we have in context, and we say, well, this couldn't be. But who's the next king? Who's the next king after Solomon? Rehoboam. How old was Rehoboam when he became king? 41. How many years does Solomon reign? 40. That means that Rehoboam, had to be born before Solomon ever becomes the king. So Solomon became king, but Rehoboam is already born. He's already born. So could he have been 12 years old? No. That means Rehoboam's born when Solomon's like 10 years old. That doesn't make any sense. Okay? So we know that he has to be at least 20. Does it make sense? Okay? And so Solomon now, referring back to his youth, okay, he comes back to God then and says, as a result of all this, he says, Lord, he says, I am just overwhelmed by your grace. Who am I that I should even become king? And now who am I that you should even be asking this question to me? He says, look, you have shown this great kasid to my father, and I am still but a child. And you want me to rule these people, your people. I get this. I have the greatest privilege on the earth to be teaching God's word to his people. This doesn't get any better than this. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, I can't think of anything else in the world that I'd rather be doing than this. I yearn to do it more. But with this privilege comes a what? A responsibility. Be not many masters, such have the greater condemnation. I am going to give an account for every word that proceeds out of my mouth in teaching you. Because if you believe what I'm teaching you, and you go out and you tell somebody else, now all of a sudden I've got thousands of people. And I've shared this in the past, but some of you haven't heard. Back in the previous church I was at, there was a woman, I could tell you her name, but that doesn't matter. We had a bread ministry, okay? We had some people who would go to the different grocery stores, and they would get the day-old bread, the bread that they were getting ready to throw away. It wasn't bad. It was just that they weren't going to keep it on their shelf. And so they went around, they got all the breads, and they brought it to the assembly where I was pastoring. And down in the fellowship hall, around the, I mean, we just had breads galore. I mean, you picture it, breads and Danishes. I mean, I gained weight during the time. Anyways, I loved rice pudding, and nobody wanted to take the rice pudding, so we always had this rice pudding. I loved rice pudding, but there's so much sugar in rice pudding. Anyways, so God gave me a caffeine allergy, so I can't eat that stuff anymore, and I lose weight. So anyways, so we had this, right? And so this woman would come, and she would get bread, so she could take it to her church to use it for ministry and distribution. Okay, it was an outreach thing. And she was moaning and complaining about somebody. And I was getting ready to preach from Luke 9 that week. And it was on, and my message title was, "Who Do You Think You Are?" And so I basically gave it to her in a nutshell. I said, "Who do you think you are?" And just told her what Jesus had said to John and to James and John and then to the other disciples and such. And she says, "Man, I need a copy of that message. This is the days, okay, how long? This is the days of cassettes, okay?" Didn't give her a CD, didn't even give her an MP3. I gave her a cassette, okay? She loved the message so much. Next week I gave it to her. I promised to give it to her, and so I gave it to her. She loved it so much, she went and made copies of it and gave it out and just kept handing it out to people. And the next week she came back and told me what she had done. She says, "I hope you don't mind if it's already been done." And, you know, and so now, I mean, I know, okay, that I'm now accountable for what? That message that's been proclaimed to all those other people. These messages are going on the internet. I know that there are people who have work in a camp in Canada who listen to my messages. They have Bob weekends, okay? That's humbling to me, okay? I mean, I listen to some of my messages, and I don't even know why you guys are here. And so, I mean, I don't get it, you know? And so, and I have people around the world who listen to these messages. They let me know this. Is this really, I mean, how humbling is that? We have a little bitty church. But the ministry goes throughout the world. I know that somebody stumbles upon these messages, I'm giving an account for what they're hearing. Does it make sense? Solomon got it. He says, "Lord, I get the opportunity. I get the privilege. But what a responsibility. If I have one thing, if I could have one thing, give me discernment that I may judge your people properly." Wisdom, understanding, discernment. Okay, all words that he's using throughout there, all different Hebraic words, which all come back to mean, I want intelligence and I want discernment to understand the times and the philosophies and the personalities of people so that when I'm forced to make a judgment, I make a judgment that is proper and true. Does that make sense? One of the words used is talking about encyclopedia-type knowledge, like we would bring today into encyclopedia-type knowledge. They didn't have a whole lot of encyclopedias back then, but it was actually literally reading, intellectual reading knowledge. It comes from the word shema, to hear, okay? And it literally means I want to be able to read and understand all the engineering things that are going on and everything else that's going on during his day. And so when the Queen of Sheba comes, and we'll talk about this, she was just confounded with all the vast knowledge that he had. Why? One of the things that Solomon wanted. He wanted this vast array, this, we use the word paideia. It's a Greek word. It's a wide range of knowledge that brings one a vast and a good, strong understanding. That's what he wanted. He wanted this discernment ability to judge the people properly. So again, I ask you, what would you have asked for? Would that be what you want? Lord, help me to have discernment that I can make right judgments. Bringing into Bob's terms even more, help me to understand your will at all times, that I can make the right judgment based upon what your will would be. Isn't that what Romans 12, 1 and 2, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, on January 1st. Isn't that what it's all about? Remember that you offer your body as a living sacrifice, which is your reasonable act of worship, and not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may be able to prove, to reveal, to discern what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So that you can do. You have to offer yourself as that living sacrifice. This is what Solomon's doing. He's laying himself out saying, God, I just want to be that king who makes right judgments. So what's the result? God says, because you've asked for this, I'm going to bless you more than what you've even asked for. And so we read this in 1 Chronicles, where God then gives him great, great wealth. And we see that in chapter 4, where we see the coming out with this. First of all, in chapter 4, down here from 1 to 19, this administration of offices, that God gives him wisdom in setting up his cabinet, the priesthood, all these things. And we're not going to go through all the different offices here. But the fact is that they're recorded for us. There's a reason that they're recorded for us. What do you think the reason is? It lets us know that Solomon was what? He was wise in his governing of the people. In a week from now-ish, we're looking forward toward the inauguration of Donald Trump as our next president. What, I don't know if you've been doing this, but what I've been watching, and I think most people have been watching over these last couple months, is his what? Who he's picking for his cabinet. Who he's going to pick to be his advisors. That's what we're reading here about Solomon. Who does Solomon put about around himself? And it's being recorded for us, so we understand that the application that he had of this wisdom, even in these offices, the administration of offices, that just in simple administration stuff, he was seeking to use this wisdom and this understanding in putting the right people together. Well, we also see then the accumulation of opulence, which is not necessarily the greatest thing, but God said he was going to give it to him. God said, because you didn't ask for it, I'm going to give it to you. Now, I think God gave it to him as a what? A test. That's exactly right, okay? Because supposedly now God is giving him the more wisdom than any man has ever had before, and so now he's going to lay this test in front of him. And so we have this accumulation of opulence. Well, what's opulence? Opulence is wealth in affluence, okay? The power you have over other people, okay? Because of the vastness of your domain and the things that you own. And so we begin to see then in chapter 4, as well as in chapter 2, chapter 1 of 2 Chronicles, the stuff that Solomon was starting to gather together, his provisions on a daily basis. And we can read some of this stuff and we go, whoa, this is just amazing. All this stuff that Solomon's getting on a daily basis, all the wheat, all the wine, all the juice, all this stuff that's coming together. And so Solomon is becoming this very, very wealthy and rich individual. I don't remember if it's next week. No, it's 3 weeks from now, because the next 2 weeks we're going to talk about the temple. We'll come back and we're going to talk about this. Again, Deuteronomy chapter 17. We looked at this last week. Okay, I mentioned it last week. Read Deuteronomy 17. What God declares for the king not to do. Okay? And what we begin to see is that Solomon begins to strike down every one of the do-nots. Boom, 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 one by one. And the final thing we're going to see him do is turn against God himself. It just happens. Even the wisest man in the world, even the one who was given the greatest wisdom, can fall down that slippery slope just like we can. And if he can do it, guess what? We can do it even better, easier. It just starts with one decision, propagating to another decision, propagating to another decision. And God, we're told, God allows us to be tested, allowed us to be tried. But he tells us in his word that he won't allow us to be tried, tested, troubled, beyond what we're able to stand, what we're able to bear. But he will, with the troublesome situation, also make a way to escape. Okay? And so I get it. God allows it. He allows these things in my life, but it's a time of testing of my faith. So we see this extent of Solomon's wealth, and then we see finally this extent of Solomon's wisdom. And I put this as the decision, not just the decision. This is the one. I mean, you have Hallmark cases, right? I mean, the things that set you apart, you know, this is the job. This is the whatever. For Solomon, this is the decision. He has this, and immediately we're told about this case. I think this case probably did come up this fast, okay? You know, that it was going to be something that was going to, it was a sign to the people that what God had done was true. And so you have these two harlots. They both have the child. Chuck read it. They both have the babies, right, within 3 days apart. So they're about the same age, okay? The one rolls over because they have the baby in the bed with them. One rolls over, sleeps on her baby, suffocates the baby dies. She realizes in the middle of the night, she wakes up, takes her baby, you know, while the other lady is sleeping, the harlot's sleeping, she takes her dead baby, puts it into the other lady's womb, takes the living baby, takes it back over here and makes sure that she doesn't roll it back over that baby. And so, and she has now the living baby, right? So the one who had the living baby, what'd I say? Okay. Whatever. So she takes the baby. She wakes up. The one who had the living baby wakes up and now has the dead baby. She says, oh, my baby is dead. Then she takes it into the light. She realizes that it's not my baby. Okay? And so she knows it's not her baby. And so she looks at the other lady's baby and says, that's my baby. She says, no, it's not your baby. It's my baby. She says, it's my baby. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. And so they take the no, not yes, it is, to Solomon, right? Because Solomon is the king, is also the judge of the land. And so they go before Solomon, and the first lady presents her case and says, you know, we both had children. You know, mine was living the night we went to bed, but next morning I woke up and it was dead. And I looked at it and it wasn't my baby. I looked at her baby and that was my baby. And she's, that wasn't your baby. Yes, it is my baby. No, it's not your baby. Yes, it is my baby. No, it's not your baby. Does this sound like your kids at home sometimes? Actually, the kids are probably saying, it sounds like my mom and dad. Anyways, and so, truth be known, huh? And so anyways, it's back and forth. And we're just told that it went on this way. That's what the Word of God says, right? And they went on this way before Solomon. And I wonder how long they went on that way before Solomon. Probably long enough for Solomon to be sitting there saying, okay, Lord, you asked? So I asked. So now I'm waiting. You've allowed this moment to come. And so I wanted discernment. I wanted to know. So you allow this situation. I haven't got a clue. She says it's my baby. She says it's my baby. How do I know whose baby it is? I mean, how do I know this lady's not lying because she's jealous? She did lay on her baby and kill her baby, and now she's jealous over her baby and she just wants her baby. Or how do I know that she didn't steal the baby at nighttime? So we're not told about, there's no verses there for that. We're just kind of left this. The next thing we read is that Solomon says, bring me a sword. How incredible is this? Could you imagine that moment? Could you imagine being in the court of Solomon watching this, listening to this? You got to, it's mine. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. And going on, and he says, stop. Okay. You said it's your baby. And she says it's not. Because she says it's her baby. But you said it's not. I believe that it's the will of the Lord at this moment is, let's bring a sword. A what? Let's bring a sword. A what? A sword. Bring me a sword! Here's the sword. All right. Let's lay the baby down. Let's go lengthwise. We don't do, you know, horizontal. Somebody gets the bottom, somebody gets the top. That doesn't make any sense. Let's go lengthwise. I mean, I know those details aren't there, but it's very important. I'm very symmetrical in my mindset, okay? And so I want to make sure we're doing this right. And so we're going to go straight, vertical this way, and we're gonna sever the baby in two, and you can have that half, and you can have that half, so you both have half of the baby. Everybody says, it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea. Could you imagine the horror, the silence that was going on in this moment? Like, he can't really mean this. How? I don't know. I think too much. My kids tell me I think too much. Anyways, and that, how long did this last? I mean, how far did they get with the sword? Until finally the mom, the real mom, says what? Stop! Stop! Oh, no, no, stop, 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 stop. Let her have the baby. Just let her have the baby. And the other lady says what? No, go ahead and slice it. Well, we should have half. What? You thought that was cute, huh? Anyways, so what do they do? Solomon says, okay, give the baby to the first woman. It's clearly her son. It's clearly her child. What did Solomon know? In the youth that he was, because of the wisdom that God had given to him, what did he know? The mother's love. That's exactly right. A real mother would rather give her child away than watch it be cut in half. That's hard as a mom, yes? You'd never want to see your child be given away. I mean, clearly you wouldn't even want to give it away to someone who's going to abuse your child, who has no concern. But when faced with the decision between watching your child die, be sliced in half, and letting somebody else have your child to raise, which would you choose? Hopefully, to give your child away. Solomon knew that. Innately, somehow, intuitively, the gift of God at that moment to know how to respond to this situation. The decision that he'll always be remembered for. Solomonic wisdom. To the point where then we're told later on, at the end of chapter 4, and you can look at there, go down to chapter 4, verse 29 to 34, that his wisdom is then compared. It says, and God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of what? Isn't that amazing? It wasn't just stoic, without any emotions kind of judgment. He gave him largeness of heart. He cared for the people. He had a love. Like the sand on the seashore, thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Isn't that interesting? Okay, who are the men of the East? The wise men, the magi, okay, that we read about in the days of coming. Those are the wise men of the East, the ones that that Daniel becomes part of when he's taken as a captive from Jerusalem and taken over into Babylon. Okay, and then we have the wisdom of Egypt, okay, where we see when Pharaoh becomes disturbed and has the dream and he calls all of his what? Wise men together, okay? And so we're told that Solomon excelled the wisdom of all those men. Verse 31, for he was wiser than all men, again, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, more than what we read, and his songs were 1,005, again, more than what we read. He spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth, who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. It wasn't just the Queen of Sheba. There were many people who came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. It's amazing when your testimony goes out, people will come to you for wisdom in the area of which you have a testimony. So, my undergraduate work's computer science and mathematics. I love math. Many people in churches in the past and such, when they have a tutoring question for math, many times people come talk to me about that. Okay, because I have a testimony, if you would, a reputation with math, okay? And so that'll happen. What's fun for me this week in Abbeville, I didn't give up sharing testimony because I kind of knew I was going to share a little bit of this right now. I think it was Wednesday. Matt and I were working in the one area, and we have a lot of Latinos working different trades up there that do not speak English at all. And so Matt is very boisterous and social, and so he kind of harasses them here and there and stuff like that. And we have a good relationship with these guys. But anyways, we were doing a countertop in this one area, and all of a sudden I hear, blah, 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 blah. That's what it sounds like to me. I'm sure if you spoke Spanish, it didn't sound like that to you. Anyways, and so Miguel, the one who can speak Spanish, he's Latino, but he speaks English as well, he's standing in the doorway, and he's turns to Matt and I, he says, he wants to know, why don't you guys cuss? We've been working there for weeks. Certain words. They understand certain words. And they and what they understand is that they never hear it from us. That when Hunter and Gabrielle were there, when Matt and I were there, they never hear us cuss. That's because they're not in my brain. Anyways, so, but no, seriously. That's a great reputation. Does that make sense? And so, to the point where this guy's sitting in there, and finally he says, why don't they cuss? And so, he's asking Miguel that. But Miguel happened to turn around and just to let us know, this is what he's asking. And so, my response was, it's because it's Jesus in me. He won't let me. I said, but if you'd have known me years ago, I could have put out a blue streak for you. I said, but when Jesus came into my life, he changed me. A man was leaving Thursday. He's the janitor. He's the best janitor I've ever seen. Man, this guy does not stop in cleaning. In fact, he's getting in trouble for cleaning too much. He's throwing people's drinks away. And so, you know, he's constantly cleaning. He's a great guy. He's an older gentleman. And so he realizes the problem with Americans today is that they don't have no pride in their work. Okay, we have a good relationship together. He came up to me specifically. There was a death in their family. He was driving to Florida. And he says, I'm coming to you because you're a godly man. I thought, wow, that is really kind of cool. This is not to be bragged on for me. I don't mean it that way. But again, your reputation goes before you. He says, I'm coming to you because you're a godly man, and I want you to pray for me. He says, I'm getting ready to travel down to Florida. And I've asked others to go with me, and no one's going to go with me, even though I'm willing to pay the whole thing. I'm going alone. And so would you pray for me as I travel to Florida and while I'm there that I can be a witness? This is the guy that I think I shared it last week, that all of a sudden started wearing a big cross. You know, he wasn't there. All of a sudden he starts wearing this big cross, you know. And just, it's really kind of cool. The kings from all the nations came to hear Solomon. They wanted to hear the wisdom of God. They didn't understand necessarily that it was the wisdom of God. Does that make sense? But they knew that there was something different about Solomon than there was in every other wise man on the earth. And they wanted to hear it on their own. Would to God that we would have that influence on the people in our realm. I promise you, Donald Trump's not going to call me because I'm a godly man and to ask me to pray for him while he's flying to wherever. That's not my realm. Does it make sense? My job, my task, is to be an influence in the realm of which God has placed me. That's where I'm a missionary. That's where I am his ambassador. And if I am conforming myself to the world and not being transformed in the renewing of my mind, then I'm not being the Solomon, if you would, that God has asked me to be in my sphere of influence, in my realm. So, back to the first question. What would you have asked for? What would you have asked God for? Would it have been like Solomon's request? Would you have been considering others in your lack? Do you recognize your limitations? What is one specific area in your life which you need to ask God to help you? Do you have limitations? You do. You have areas of failures. There is definitely a sin that easily besets you. If it's not just one, it's many. The wisest man knows his greatest weakness, and he's willing to admit it. You guys who are and have been military, you know, I've talked about this, Rodney, right? You know your weak area, and you defend against it. You build up. You understand. To ignore your weaknesses is foolishness. Solomon understood his weakness was going to be his youthfulness and asked God to overcome it. Are you truly grateful for the merciful loving kindness that God has bestowed upon you for his chesed? I'm overwhelmed by it. I really am. I know I don't seem like it sometimes, but that is the thing that just overwhelms me. I know who I have been, and I know who I am. And to be given the privilege to be used by God for his kingdom's glory is beyond what I can... I'm going to cry. It's beyond what I can ever imagine. For the God of the universe to allow me to influence others for Him. I think we take it for granted. And it's something that we shouldn't be taking for granted. And finally then, is there a need for you to change the way you think, therefore change the way you act? Again, for those who are new, the word repent is the Greek word metanoia. It means change the way you think. We need to be able to repent. That message of repentance is for all of us, not just for sinners. It's even for believers. We are to change the way we think and line up the way we think with the way God thinks. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for your love. Forgive us, Lord, for taking you for granted. Oh, Lord, you have blessed us and bestowed us with so many things. And we just take them for granted. Lord, help us to desire the things you desire, to hunger for the things that you have passion for. We know that you desire all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So Lord, help us to desire to win souls, for we know that you've said that he who wins souls is wise. Lord, help us to walk in your wisdom for your glory. In Christ's name, amen.